Hello, and welcome to Medium Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is Saturday, July 3rd, 2004. Today's session number is MED 2004-05. Today's speaker is David Mezenbring. The lesson for today is Broadening Community to Better Discern the Summons. Summoning from the Grave, Steve Biko's Martyred Voice. Let's listen in.
Start. My name is David Mezenbring, and this session is called Summoning from the Grave.
I better look it up, I forgot what it's called.
Summoning from the Grave, Steve Biko's Martyred Voice. Bantu Steve Biko, that was his name, was born in 1946. His father died very young, and his family was kind of adopted by, in a religious sort of way at least, by a Community of the Resurrection priest from England named Aelred Stubbs, who got to know Steve better than any other white person. Although there is a white person better known for his relationship with Biko by the name of Donald Woods, who wrote a book called Biko that I think should have been called Woods, and who really is the feature of the film Cry Freedom. How many have seen the film? Okay. And how many have seen the book called Biko that I just defamed? None. The film by Richard Attenborough was his first after Gandhi. It really did not do very well for reasons that I think make an interesting analysis of Hollywood, but I'm not sure we have time for. Maybe in our discussion at the end, if you're interested, we can go into that. I will just say that in the film, there's a woman doctor who was a close colleague of Steve's who's featured, and the film so depressed her that she got very depressed and actually hatched to recover a relationship with the church and go through some counseling to come out of her depression about the film for the way in which it didn't really reflect the reputation of the man. Bantu it's curious that Steve was named Bantu. Bantu in Xhosa, his native language, means people. And it was also, was used as kind of a derogatory term by Afrikaners for blacks. And the fact that a mother would name her son, or maybe the father was involved in the naming, I'm not sure. The fact that parents would name their son Bantu is almost, is a great example of why a black consciousness movement was needed. And that's what Steve gifted South Africa with in his very short life. I'll try and remember to teach you that proverb at the end, Umtum Bumtum Gabantu, which uses the root of his name, Bantu Steve Biko. Aelred Stubbs got involved as a priest nearby the home, was aware that the family had lost the father. There were a couple of siblings and a very strong, very impressive mother. And over the course of Steve's life, Aelred was not extensively involved when Steve was growing up, but he knew the boy and actually played a role in getting some good missionary education for the boy out of a pitied concern that the father wasn't around to help provide for the son. After graduating from mission school, Steve went to medical school at the University of Durban and got very involved in student politics, heavily so. And the politics of the day were to choose between one of two organizations. South Africa had these two white cultures, Afrikaners and English, and they hated each other. I've done sessions a long time ago in the village about the enmity between the English-speaking Afrikaners, the English-speaking whites, and the Afrikaans-speaking whites. The two student organizations mirrored these two communities. There was the ASB, the Afrikaner Studentenbond, Afrikaans Students organization among university students at the Afrikaans universities. And then there was NUSAS, the National Union of South African Students, which was really an English, white liberal-led group. Steve got heavily involved in that multiracial, liberal, white-led group. You can't argue that he formed SASO, I forgot to put up here, South African Students Organization. You can't say that he formed SASO because he was jealous that he couldn't make it in NUSAS. He was spectacularly successful at his Durban-Westville black medical school campus, black and so-called colored. He was very successful on that campus at regenerating that campus's participation in NUSAS. But he got so involved in NUSAS that he came to see its limits. And as we'll read and see here as we go through this, that's what caused him to break away and form a black students organization. I got to know Steve through Aylred. I had a good relation, close, still have a close relationship with Aylred Stubbs. And Aylred introduced me to Steve at one point. It's kind of a long story how we met. A couple of you have heard it. It was just a coincidence that I was driving several hundred miles in a car with a bunch of other people after a meeting of seminary teachers, and we stopped in Steve's hometown, King Williamstown, at this little church to pick up a baby crib that someone in the car needed from what turns out to be the offices of Black Community Programs, Steve's office. And I walked around behind the building. This was December of 76, just a few days after Steve had been released from detention. And I recognized Aylred's car, and the car, I saw the license plate, I knew that was his car. It was a Johannesburg plates and the same kind of car that he drove. And right at that moment, he walks out of a building. He says, "Oh, David, I was just telling Steve about you this morning. Come inside." And then I was suddenly, meet Bigo, we're on the run. You know, it's a 5-minute rest stop on this long drive. But he said he invited me to come back and spend some time with him, which I did about a month or two later. That would have been in January or February of 77. In June of 77, I saw him again under circumstances I really won't explain just because it takes too much time. And then in August 18th, he was detained for the last time and killed on September 12th. I learned more about him from the research that I did after his death. Aylred Stubbs, between June, in about July of 77, a month before Steve's final detention, Aylred had gone home to visit his mother in England. British passport holders did not need South African visas at that point. But while he was at home in England, he received a visit from the South African consulate in London, delivering a letter to him telling him that he would not be allowed back into the country. And he went to Lesotho, which is a tiny mountain kingdom surrounded by South Africa, and began a contemplative life of prayer, again learning that by staying at an Anglican nun, an Anglican convent of contemplative nuns. I took over the position, the program that Aylred was running in Johannesburg, a theological education program, and about 5 weeks, Steve was killed September 12th. October 19th was a major crackdown of all the organizations that had been part of the Black Consciousness Movement. And a lot of people were rounded up and put into detention. And a few days later, Aylred smuggled a letter in to me saying that he had been asked to do a biography of Steve, and would I go consult the family and friends to see whether or not they would agree to this, and if they did, would I go on and meet with some other key people who were very close to Steve and ask them what they thought. It's significant that Stubbs had the discipline to do that, even though he wasn't in the country, before he picked up a pen. Unlike Donald Woods, who was one of the people that Aylred had asked me to go and consult, and I'll never forget Donald. When I saw him and I told him what I was up to and that Aylred wanted to know his opinion of whether or not he should take on such a book. Donald was already writing his book at that point, although he didn't say a word about it to me, of course. And when he heard that I had just come from visiting Steve's widow and mother, what did they say? It was very significant that Aylred acted with the discipline of the community and the family, unlike Woods. I learned a lot about Biko in the course of moving around and trying to dig up some of his material. In the end, we decided not to do a biography, but to let Steve speak for himself in this book, which this is another out-of-print edition. This is the in-print edition, which is in the bookstore. To let Steve speak for himself, because he was so articulate. He had really the capacity to communicate profound new thinking in a very accessible way. He really was had a philosophical mind, a keen intellect, but he also had the ability to communicate that stuff in a very easy to understand way, as you'll hear when we start reading some of his material. So we got the material together. There's some stories that would be dramatic about how the material got out and got published, but far more helpful to us, I think, would be to hear from the man himself and let him summon us from his grave. One of the things that I observed and that comes through in his writings was a characteristic style of very tough talk. I hope when they design the redo Koinonia, they find ways that you don't have to keep moving around to see everybody. Very tough talk in terms of the policies that he laid down, but maintained very warm personal relationships. Nusas was deeply offended by the formation of SASO. So the Black Students Organization, when it broke away from the multiracial, white liberal-led organization, the white liberals screamed, "Oh no, apartheid has been successful. Blacks have bought into the separation of the races." Now, interestingly enough, that bought Steve and his colleagues a lot of time. Because the Afrikaners figured if the English-speaking liberals are against it, it must be a good thing. Really, they did. And they missed the threat that this movement posed until it was too late and they couldn't stop it anymore. All right. One of the first chapters in the book was a letter that Steve had written to the leaders of the Afrikaner Student Organization, the leaders of NUSAS, the leaders of some international student organizations, in which he lays out, really, the rationale for why this black separatist organization had been founded. And it was an effort on his part to defend the decision and to explain the historic circumstances and, in a way, to share the reflection of his own thinking about what had led them to withdraw from NUSAS. He writes, "One of the most talked about topics was at these conferences of NUSAS that he went to and participated in. One of the most talked about topics was the position of the black students in the quote-unquote open organizations like NUSAS and UCM, University Christian Movement, which was another multiracial white-led, liberal white-led students' organization that Steve had been active in. Concern was expressed that these were white-dominated and paid very little attention to problems peculiar to the black community. In fact, some people began to question the very competence of pluralistic groups to examine without bias problems affecting one group, especially if the unaffected group is from the oppressor camp. It was felt that a time had come when blacks had to formulate their own thinking unpolluted by ideas emanating from a group with lots at stake in the status quo." I wrote an article for the next issue of Holden News late last night that tries to draw the parallel of that thinking to the situation of Americans on the global stage. While these aims might appear, and then he sets out the aims of SASO. He's making the case for why blacks withdrew into their own organization where they could have some leadership of their own. And after he lays out those aims, he says, "While these aims might appear to be couched in racial language, they are in fact a sign that the black student community has at last lost faith with their white counterparts and is now withdrawing from the open society. The blacks are tired of standing at the touch lines, that's a rugby term, in American football terms, it'd be on the sidelines. Blacks are tired of standing on the sidelines to witness a game that they should be playing. They want to do things for themselves and all by themselves. Sasso was formed. Steve's medical studies started going downhill fast as he moved from black campus around the country, trying to explain to fellow black university students what Sasso was about. Sasso started a newsletter, and Steve, for reasons would take more time than we can go into right now, was very keen not to evolve a leadership cult. So he always acted to keep the focus off of himself. He was the president of Sasso, but at the end of his one-year term, when everyone said, "Now you stand for re-election," he said, "No." And as a result, he said, "We don't need a leadership cult. We need lots of leaders. We need lots of people to get leadership experience." Barney Pichana, who I spoke about a couple of days ago and who has gone on to a tremendous career of leadership in the country, was elected the second president. Steve, in evidence of his refusal to take the limelight, wrote a column in the Sasso newsletter and signed it Frank Talk. In order to keep the focus off of who he was and on the ideas. And several of the, his column in that Sasso newsletter was called "I Write What I Like," and that gives title to the book, "I Write What I Like." My favorite, or maybe it's not my favorite, but it's the most personally meaningful to me, article that he wrote for that column is called "Black Souls and White Skins? ?" And it's about the role of white liberals. Can we really, although we have white skins, claim to have a black soul or to be in solidarity with black people, or the kind of solidarity that presumes to speak for them? I'm over here today because the light is better.
You refuse to wear glasses.
Yeah, and I refuse to. And because I haven't been able to find an optometrist here in the village.
I hear you. I'm right here.
Oh, you're all right. Well, see if we can fit it in between this session and the 10:45.
10 seconds.
It was one of the earlier pieces that he wrote, and it was specifically aimed at a black audience to help them understand the limits of putting too much faith too much hope that white liberals are going to save the day. We are concerned with, in setting out at the beginning of the article, he says, "We're concerned here with that curious bunch of nonconformists who explain their participation in negative terms, that bunch of do-gooders that goes under all sorts of names, liberals, leftists, etc. These are people who argue that they're not responsible for white racism and the country's inhumanity to the black man. These are the people who claim that they too feel the oppression just as acutely as the blacks, and therefore should be jointly involved in the black man's struggle for a place under the sun. In short, these are people who say that they have black souls wrapped up in white skins. Very few black organizations in the history of South Africa were not under white direction. True to their image, the white liberals always knew what was good for the blacks and told them so. The wonder of it all is that black people have believed them for so long." Skipping a few paragraphs. "Once the various groups within a given community have asserted themselves," he's talking about, I won't read it all, but I'll tell you what was in there. He talks about how the white liberals insist that integration is not only the end goal, but also the means. And here he begins to unpack this notion that there are two problems in South Africa: a problem of a white superiority complex and a problem of a black inferiority complex. And that if you rush toward integration too quickly, what happens is that blacks carrying their inferiority complex into a circle of people with a superiority complex, you don't really have true integration. And if we had a little more time, I'll bet you we'd have a fascinating discussion right now, thinking about all the places we have seen that to be true. Whether we're talking about Lutheran, global Lutheran church circles, where you really expect an independent voice to come from people who are all heavily dependent on our income. Or think about the women's movement. It was not, I credit the women's movement in my own experience of that in the 70s, early 70s, with helping me recognize the validity of this. Women withdrew to women's groups, right? To really get confident about their voice before they spoke as strongly as they came to speak to men. Men were very threatened that women were moving off by themselves. What are they talking about? You know? Remember? Some of them? Yeah. Once the various groups within a given community have asserted themselves to the point that mutual respect has to be shown them, then you have the ingredients for a true and meaningful integration. How true? So he's making it clear here that the black withdrawal, the withdrawal into the black caucus, is not an end objective. It's the means to the end. And then once blacks have recovered, once they have dealt with the problem of a black inferiority complex and reconstituted a sense of their own humanity and who they are, then they'd be able to relate as equals to the whites. From this, it becomes clear that as long as blacks are suffering from an inferiority complex, a result of 300 years of deliberate oppression, denigration, and derision, they will be useless. That as long as they're suffering, they will be useless as co-architects of a normal society. Hence, what is necessary as a prelude to anything else that may come is a very strong grassroots buildup of black consciousness, such that blacks can learn to assert themselves and stake their rightful claim. The myth of integration as propounded under the banner of liberal ideology must be cracked and killed, because it makes people believe that something is being done, when in actual fact the artificial integrated circles are soporific on the blacks and provide a vague satisfaction for the guilty stricken whites. Talks about white liberals holding tea parties where blacks feel thrilled to be invited to tea in white homes. And the more tea parties I, as a white liberal, can claim to have held with blacks, the more liberal I am. And another point, he talked about how NUSAS, the white liberal-led multiracial students organization, really didn't have a program for resolving the problem in the country at all. They would just get together, and all these various white liberals would compete with one another to see who was more liberal than the other, who was holier than thou. Sounds familiar. Liberals waste lots of time trying to prove to as many blacks as they can that they are liberal. This arises out of the false belief that we are faced with a black problem. There is nothing the matter with blacks. The problem is white racism, and it rests squarely on the laps of white society. White liberals must leave blacks to take care of their own business while they concern themselves with the real evil in our society, white racism. That was the point he made to me that sent me back home to the States and into an advocacy role. I loved my time in South Africa. I'd love to have spent my whole career in Africa. But I really heard from him a sense that who better to address the problem of U.S. support for white apartheid South Africa than an American working within, and that I should go home and work on my own problem and let them work on their own liberation. Does this mean that I'm against integration? If by integration you understand a breakthrough into white society by blacks, an assimilation and acceptance of blacks into an already established set of norms and code of behavior set up and maintained by whites, then yes, I'm against it. I'm against the superior, inferior white-black stratification that makes a white a perpetual teacher of the blacks and the black a perpetual pupil and a poor one at that. I'm against the intellectual arrogance of white people that makes them believe that white leadership is a sine qua non in this country, and that whites are the divinely appointed pace setters in progress. I'm against the fact that a settler minority should impose an entire system of values on an indigenous people. If, on the other hand, by integration you mean that there shall be free participation by all members of a society, catering for the full expression of the self in a freely changing society as determined by the will of the people, then I'm with you. For one cannot escape the fact that the culture shared by the minority group in any given society must ultimately determine the broad direction taken by the joint culture of that society. This need not cramp the style of those who feel differently, but on the whole, a country in Africa in which the majority of the people are African must inevitably exhibit African values and be truly African in style. Black souls and white skins. My housemate Jeff has been reading the book this week and said that what he really liked was the way Steve testified at a trial in 1976. The material that's in this book, profound as it is remarkable for the short window early in this man's life that he wrote. All these pieces are written between 1969 and 1972, when he would be, 25 years old. In 1973, he was banned. And to be banned in South Africa at that time meant you can't travel, you can't speak publicly, and you can't write for publication. And I was unable to find any major, apart from a few letters, any major writing that he did after the point that he was banned. Our loss. In about 1974,
say, David, was his thinking different than the civil rights leaders in our country during the 60s? I mean, did he borrow anything from them?
He did. He read the Black Consciousness material that came out of the States, and it fueled his thinking. That term, black souls and white skins, he borrowed from Frantz Fanon, the Algerian nationalist. So it wasn't just the United States. He had read from the continent of Africa, he had read from African-American writings, and he put his own spin on it. Who asked the question?
No,
Does that help?
Yeah,
I mean, that was one of the streams.
Some of the stuff is going on in the 60s. I mean, I think that white liberals in our country also were kind of told to stay out of it, or felt left out. Especially when the violence started in Watts and places like that, we realized, I mean, I think white people felt that we're not in control here. We're out of this, we're out of the loop. And he must have noticed that.
Yeah. Paul?
The language, in fact, of a lot of fiction writers and poets of the 60s and 70s was, we don't need white liberals, we need white radicals. And their image of that was somebody who was willing to just change the entire status quo, not just integrate.
Right. He a couple of times he speaks to the issue of relationship with whites and the hurt feelings on the part of the white liberals. And he says, well, don't feel too bad. We at least consider you still worth talking to. Unlike the Afrikaners, who they were on record wanting nothing to do with. I once arranged for an Afrikaner journalist who I thought was a bright light, a great mind, to go and see him. And Steve, at my recommendation, agreed to meet with her. They spent a whole afternoon and evening together, and then he argued deep into the night. He asked her to stay overnight and spend some more time with some of his colleagues the following day. And he had to argue deep into the night, bitterly, with some of his colleagues about whether or not it was worth their time to meet with this Afrikaner journalist. He went to bat for an Afrikaner journalist that he thought was a good person to invest time with. He would have, had he lived, there's no question, he would have been like a Mandela in the sense of promoting constructive relations among the races. There's no question in my mind that he'd be president today, and a much better one than we have, had he lived.
Did that journalist ever write anything up?
She did. After his death, she which shocked her. I called her and told her as soon as I got the news, and she couldn't believe it. And she said, come over to my office. And between the time I called her and the time I got to her office, she had checked with her sources, learned that it was true. And it disturbed her greatly. And she wrote a very powerful piece. She had a column. In South Africa, you have dailies newspapers and you have Sunday newspapers. And at that time, she was the assistant editor of Report, the Afrikaans Sunday newspaper, the only one in the country. Had tremendous circulation among the Afrikaner community. And she had a very famous column on the editorial page every Sunday. And the Sunday after his death, she wrote about him and said, something's wrong here. I don't buy anymore the notion that these people are killing themselves in police detention because they're communists and this is what they've been trained to do. She said, I saw this man and he was our hope and he's dead. And it was so powerful that it was translated and published in the most liberal, most progressive white English-speaking publication of the country. They did a whole issue. The editor of that publication was a close friend of Steve's, and he dedicated a whole issue to Steve, and he reprinted this, which is unthinkable, you know, that a piece of Afrikaans from an Afrikaner newspaper would get picked up. She just died. She just died a few days before New Year's Eve. She was a dear friend of mine, but we saw her last summer. In about 74, when Mozambique, over here on the border of South Africa, which had been a Portuguese colony, and the Portuguese withdrew after a military coup in Portugal that said, we're draining our society by fighting these colonial wars in Angola and Mozambique. The military leaders had a coup, and they withdrew. And black community programs in Durban, very close by Maputo and Mozambique, black community programs people organized a rally to celebrate liberation that had come to Mozambique. The government went nuts, of course, and put on trial about 8 or 9 leaders of the black community programs in a trial that ran for a year and a half or something like that. I think they decided that for some reason, they didn't charge Steve, but the defense called Steve as a witness. And a couple of the chapters in the book, and in fact, there's a whole book of Steve's testimony at that trial. A couple of the chapters in here are examples of Steve's conversation, his testimony at the trial, which was brilliant. Jeff liked him a lot, and we were talking about it, and I said, it's because he understood the thinking of the Afrikaner judge and the Afrikaner prosecuting attorney. He understood them better than they understood him. And so they would start off trying to paint him into a corner, and he would just turn the tables on them so fast and use their question, really, to make some strong point that he wanted to make. But I'm not sure we can do everything here. Maybe we can just get a little piece of it. He became the toast of Soweto overnight because the Johannesburg newspapers covered this trial. Now, it's a long piece about, it's brilliant stuff. My favorite piece in the book is an article that he wrote for a collection of essays on black theology. And it's called Black Consciousness and the Quest for a True Humanity. And it's illustrative. It's a great illustration of a lot of the themes that they stood for. We have to find out whether our position, the position of blacks in an apartheid society, which of course, you know, what may not be known to you, but certainly what is known to him and his compatriots, is that apartheid began in the Christian church over the issue of whether or not to include blacks and whites at a common communion table. This whole business of close communion gets us in so much trouble, it's unbelievable. And 100 years later, spread into the political realm, when the Afrikaner Nationalist Party was elected to a majority position in the government. Steve writes, "We have to find out whether our position is a deliberate creation of God or an artificial fabrication of the truth by power-hungry people whose motive is authority, security, wealth, and comfort. In other words, the black consciousness approach would be irrelevant in a colorless and non-exploitative egalitarian society. It is relevant here because we believe that an anomalous situation is a deliberate creation of man." He uses, forgive him a little bit for the sexist terminology here. I have it on first-hand information from a number of women that knew him that he was unusually respectful of women for his day and culture. But his writings at that time in the mid-70s used the used sexist language for in reference to all people. "Whenever a group of people has tasted the lovely fruits of wealth, security, and prestige," would that be us too? "it begins to find it more comfortable to believe in the obvious lie and to accept it as normal that it alone is entitled to privilege. In order to believe this seriously, it needs to convince itself of all the arguments that support the lie. It's not surprising, therefore, that in South Africa, after generations of exploitation, white people on the whole have come to believe in the inferiority of the black man." It appears to us as too much of a coincidence that liberals, few as they are, should not only be determining the modus operandi of those blacks who oppose the system, but also leading it in spite of their involvement in the system. To us, it seems that their role spells out the totality of the white power structure. The fact that though whites are our problem, it still takes other whites who want to tell us how to deal with that problem. They do so by dragging all sorts of red herrings across our paths. They tell us that the situation is a class struggle rather than a racial one. Let them go to Van Tonder in the Free State and tell him this." Van Tonder is just a common Afrikaans name for like a poor white farmer. "We believe we know what the problem is and we will stick by our findings. We must learn to accept that no group, however benevolent, can ever hand power to the vanquished on a plate. We must accept that the limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they can oppress. As long as we go to Whitey begging cap in hand for our own emancipation, we are giving him further sanction to continue with his racist and oppressive system. We must realize that our situation is not a mistake on the part of whites, but a deliberate act, and that no amount of moral lecturing will persuade the white to correct the situation." Skipping a few paragraphs. "The black consciousness is an attitude of mind and a way of life. The most positive call to emanate from the black world for a long time. Its essence is the realization by the black man of the need to rally together with his brothers around the cause of their oppression, the blackness of their skin, and to operate as a group to rid themselves of the shackles that bind them to perpetual servitude. It is based on a self-examination which has ultimately led them to believe that by seeking to run away from themselves and emulate the white man, they are insulting the intelligence of whoever created them black. The philosophy of black consciousness therefore expresses group pride and the determination of the black man to rise and attain the envisaged self. Freedom is the ability to define oneself with one's possibilities held back not by the power of other people over one, but only by one's relationship to God and to natural surroundings. On his own, therefore, the black man wishes to explore his surroundings and test his possibilities. In other words, to make his freedom real by whatever means he deems it." I'm looking for a phrase here. I don't find it. He goes on to talk a little bit about the role of the missionaries. "The first people to come and relate to blacks in a human way," that's a compliment, "in South Africa were the missionaries. They were the vanguard of the colonialism movement to civilize and educate the savages and introduce the Christian message to them. skipping a few lines, we did not find it compatible with our way of life to worship God in isolation from the various aspects of our lives. He criticizes this notion that what missionaries brought was the idea that you worship God in a separate building one time a week. He said, in our culture, we did it all the time and wherever we were, in our homes. We've lost something if we give that up. They argued that theirs was a scientific religion and ours a superstition. While I do not wish to question the basic truth at the heart of the Christian message, there is a very strong case for re-examination of Christianity. It has proved a very adaptable religion, which does not seek to supplement existing orders, but, like any universal truth, to find application within a particular situation. More than anyone else, the missionaries knew that not all they did was essential to the spread of the gospel. Keep in mind some of the things we said on Tuesday. But the basic intention went much farther than merely spreading the word. Their arrogance and their monopoly on truth, beauty, and moral judgment taught them to despise native customs and traditions and to seek to infuse their own view, new values, into these societies. Here then we have the case for black theology. While not wishing to discuss black theology at length, let it suffice to say that it seeks to relate God and Christ once more to the black man and his daily problems. It wants to describe Christ as a fighting God, not a passive God, who allows a lie to rest unchallenged. It seeks to bring back God to the black man and to the truth and reality of his situation. This is an important aspect of black consciousness, for quite a large proportion of black people in South Africa are Christians, still swimming in a mire of confusion, the aftermath of the missionary approach. It is the duty, therefore, of all black priests and ministers of religion to save Christianity by adopting black theology's approach and thereby once more uniting the black man with his God. I had it, but in the course of skipping some stuff here, I lost that phrase that blacks have to begin to look upon themselves as a human being. When Steve got banned in 1973, he was in Durban, big urban area, cosmopolitan, lots of excitement culturally and intellectually. And one of the things that the system did in an effort to silence him was to banish him to his hometown in King Williamstown, which Griffiths and Klenge told me that when he was on Robben Island, he was also from King Williamstown, when he was on Robben Island, he was often teased by his fellow political prisoners for coming from one of the worst political backwaters anywhere in South Africa. They would use King Williamstown to refer to the place where white control was so strong. Steve is banished to King Williamstown, and his banning orders explicitly reference the fact that he can have nothing to do with SASO, South African Students Organization, the political wing that had grown up. So what does he do? He goes out and forms a new organization, Black Community Programs, which set up black self-help projects, a medical clinic, a leatherworking operation, educational programs, black designed, black built, black staffed, black run programs that operate in wherever he can find the people and get the energy to get them started. As a way of making a case to the surrounding black community that we can do things for ourselves and maybe even do them better than we've been getting them done for us by the whites. Black Community Programs, because of its ostensibly apolitical nature, escaped, operated under the radar of the security police. and bought them some time. And by the time that Soweto blew up in 1976, the young students, it's significant, I think, Steve testified at that trial against the Black Consciousness Movement and some of his colleagues in May of 1976. In June 16th of 1976, just a month later, and I said that his testimony at the trial made him the toast of Soweto. Soweto, this huge urban township outside Johannesburg. Because the papers were covering it. The black press covered what Steve said. The white press had a small article about the fact that this trial was going on, but they wouldn't give a lot of space, a lot of copy, to what Biko was saying and the way he turned the tables on his questioners. The black press in Soweto did. And overnight, in the shebeens of Soweto, the informal bars, Biko was the toast of the town. And it's significant that the students who had been on this anti-Afrikaans momentum, on June 16th, they're holding a big march, and the police start shooting them. And instead of people running for cover and cowering in fear, they just kept coming. And the whole place blew up, and the whole country, township after township around the country, blew up for months. So in the wake of that, immediately, the government detains Biko and some of his colleagues and start torturing them. They didn't lay a hand on Steve because they knew at that point in 76, because they knew of his connections internationally. The U.S. congressman would come and see him, and he was developing an international reputation. But they took a particularly close woman friend of his. And every time Steve refused to answer questions, she got beat up badly. I saw her right after she came out of detention. She was a mess. And of course, when they are both released and they compare notes, what's the message to him? When I don't talk, they beat up one of my friends. He was in detention from late June of 76 until mid-December of 76. He was out from December until August 18th. He had a reputation for not respecting his banning order. Port Elizabeth was a couple hours away, and he had a way of slipping down to Port Elizabeth, being seen on the streets, and back to King Williamstown before the security police heard and the whole community say, Biko was here today. You know, he's banned, but he was here in Port Elizabeth today. In August of 77, he was on a very important mission. The political powers of the black community in South Africa were exiled in 1960. The African National Congress, which is now by far the majority party of the country, and the Pan-Africanist Congress. Those two organizations were both banned and went into exile in the 1960s. And they maintained a bitter rivalry with one another, which people inside the country were frustrated about. And Steve, a great reconciler, and hugely popular now in the black, in the urban black community of South Africa, was on a mission to, went to Cape Town to talk with some people about plans to smuggle him out of the country and to a secret meeting in Europe where he would try and mediate between the ANC and the PAC and see if, you know, communicate from inside the country some sense of urgency that you guys, you know, we're waiting for you to launch the liberation movement. And you're sitting here fat and happy in exile and arguing with one another. And meanwhile, we're dying by like flies at home. And you got to, he would have been a potent voice in that regard. On his way back from Cape Town, he got snagged in a roadblock that was set up for another purpose. They didn't know that he was gone. And the roadblock caught him. He went into detention August 18th, and was held naked and manacled and interrogated and beaten to death. I learned about it. It's significant how I learned of his death. Stubbs had been kicked out, partly because Stubbs would have been Aylward knew Steve better than any other white, and he had his religious community had kind of blessed him in a ministry among the band, and he would move among these band people and carry messages, and it was kind of a pastoral ministry, officially and actually, but it also played a very valuable communication role among people who had been very close and who the banning process separated.
Where's it going with that? How you found out about his death?
Thank you. Aylward gets kicked out. I had just been fired from another position after taking Steve's advice about what to do about a predicament that I was in. And Aylward asked me to fill in for him. He was leading a very creative theological education training program in Johannesburg. So I filled in that, and I had a black assistant at the monastery where of Aylward's religious community, where the office was. And there were it was a monastery, and there weren't phones, there wasn't a phone in our office, but the phone would ring kind of on a loudspeaker system. And my assistant, Massimo, had asked for a couple of days off to go to Kimberley, which was a couple hours of drive away from Johannesburg, to attend the inquest into the death in police custody of her nephew, who was an Anglican youth worker. I forget his name now, it's 25 years. But I remember that Massimo's nephew was a youth worker for the Anglican Church who had been detained in Kimberley and came home dead. And Massimo said, I just want to go and sit in that courtroom. I know there will be no justice, but I want to look into their eyes. And she went. Did that. And came back and told me the story. And I cried with her. The phone rang. She went to answer it and came back and said, Steve is dead. Look what a gift we miss by not approaching people for what they offer us. I made it a passion. I have the privilege of working in 25 African countries after I learned Khalsa. And everywhere I went, it became a compulsive passion of mine to find out if those people had the same proverb I had learned in Khalsa that I'm going to teach you right now. Umju, gumju, Gaban. It's the same word three times. I never found a language in Africa that didn't recognize the proverb immediately and give me their equivalent. It's the same word three times. In Xhosa, a little bit of grammar changes a prefix changes the grammar and gives it a grammatical context. Person, person. Abantu is the plural form of umtu. Person, person, people. A person is a person because of other people. So a rural Khalsa mother can feed her five children by putting all the food in one bowl with a single spoon, hand it to her eldest child and say, now, you share this food with your brothers and sisters because a person is a person because of other people. And if you don't share it, then you're less than all God made you to be. I'm the oldest of five children. If my mother had fed us by putting all the food in one bowl with one spoon and handed it to me in a culture that teaches me to go out and get as much as I can for myself and even look up to the people that got more than their share, I would have eaten better than my brothers and sisters. Now, I think that orientation toward the individual that comes out, that is our cultural heritage, has a lot of strength, but nothing is, no strength is without its underside, right? And that cultural strength has been spread widely around the world. It's time for us to complement our strengths with the cultural strength of others. And this would be a good place to start. Beagle, in the book, over and over, stresses that it's our humanity that will be Africa's gift, and we owe it to the world to free ourselves from people who are never going to set us free anyway, if we, as long as we wait around for it to happen. Because God gave us that gift to share with other people. We have never lived in a time when we are more in need of the gifts God gave Africa to be shared with us. But as long as our superiority complex goes out into the world saying, how can we help you? And ignoring the fact that we have used the world to help ourselves better than anybody else, right? Then we're not going to get the gifts God gave us in other people. We got 5 minutes for some discussion after a long lecture. Probably all sleeping and there's nobody.
I apologize for being late. You probably said this at the beginning. How or when did you meet Stephen Biko?
I met him, I did say it at the beginning. And
do you mind?
Well, I mind for their sake. Maybe there's another question. If there's no other question, we'll come back to that one. But you could also listen. If you just went to the beginning of the tape tomorrow or whatever, you could I could pick that up.
I find it interesting that Denzel Washington, who played...
played Steve in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Also played
Malcolm X.
Uh-huh. Looks like, walks like, talks like, moves uh-huh. like, and lives his life like those two men.
Yeah. One of my problems with the film is that Biko died in the middle of it, right? And it goes on to sort of make heroic woods. I think what happened, movies, you know, they go through their scripting phase and then they line up the financing, and that's the big piece. Who's going to put big bucks into this based on the notion that it's gonna be a box office hit? Well, the financing decisions, the finalization of the script, and the investment decisions happened before TransAfrica began their campaign of demonstrating in front of South African embassies. Some of you who are a little older will remember that in about 1984-85, while the film was under production and before it came out, a African-American organization, political organization, that called itself a Lobby for Africa and the Caribbean, started staging demonstrations in front of the South African consulates. And it became the rage for liberals all over the country to get arrested demonstrating at a South African embassy. How many remember that? That's right. And that was one of the first times that African Americans really, as black people, came to be seen as spokesmen for African rights, I think. Anybody, am I wrong about that? One of the first times, at least in my lifetime. Then the film, now I think the financiers of Hollywood said, well, you know, we got to have a movie that people can relate to. If they can't relate to it, they won't go to it. We need a hero in the film that people can relate to, and they won't relate to this black man, but there's this guy, Donald Woods, who risked his life to get the book about Biko out and to tell the story about Biko, so let's build the film around him. And it fell flat. The reviews, it was widely seen, but I can't remember a substantive review that didn't express disappointment about the fact that, hey, the Biko guy's kind of interesting, but we don't see as much of him as we see of this other guy. I think that the consciousness of the public changed while the film was under production, and that they just made a mistake in what they thought we would relate to, because the public was more ready by the time the film was done than it was at the beginning to actually see a black hero. And then Rick and then Paul.
Yeah, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, where you see, I mean, you talked a little bit about where South Africa is today earlier, but if you could talk about where South Africa is today in its ability to, and Africa for that matter, transmit the message you're talking about. And
that's not summoning from the grave. That's, you know, that's predicting the future. I don't know. I'm not enough in touch, really. I'm not. I often say I worked for 15 years with all kinds of Africans, and the last 13 years I've worked with everybody except Africans. You know, I mean, the whole world comes into our seaport, but very few Africans. Once in a while, a South African ship, and that's a lot of fun, but not very often. I don't think I know well enough. I think I was struck when I went back last summer by how much optimism there was and by some things that were going on Africa-wide that I had been totally unaware of. I, as somebody who loves Africa and who studied Africa and who tries to, I can't say I keep up like an academic or anything like that, but I was struck by how much more was going on than I thought. At the same time, Africa economically is unquestionably in the worst shape of any continent in the world, just unquestionably. And AIDS is 30 million of the world's 40 million HIV-infected people live in sub-Saharan Africa. Africa is off of our radar screen, and we are the losers for that. And it's not going to get back on our agenda anytime soon under the Bush administration, I can assure you that. I had lunch with Condoleezza Rice in 1977. She was in graduate school with one of my closest friends. And after Bush got elected and she got appointed, my friend called me up and reminded me of what I had said to him after lunch. I told him that she would go far, because she was so ambitious that she was willing to buy into whatever would be the popular line that would get her promoted. Mm-hmm. I told him that after lunch. And we talked about South Africa stuff. And judging from where she was at and where she came down on South African policy at that time, I said, oh, she'll do very well. Not because she was so intelligent, but because she was ambitious. Paul.
I'll bet everybody in here has heard of Richard Wright and heard of Native Son and Black Boy. Has anybody in here heard of Richard Wright's book called The Color Curtain? And the reason I ask that is just to support your contention and of Africa's off the radar map and considering black and white relationships worldwide. He did that in The Color Curtain in the 50s, and he was so far ahead of his time that nobody paid any attention to that, pointing out things in South Africa, but throughout the world, of how people of color are victimized by white superiority, but with real, the same kind of thinking that Vico did. But as you said, nobody paid any attention to it, but they would pay attention, of course, a little bit to Black Boy and Native Son and so on. Mm-hmm.
One more.
I was going to mention this, and it's an author as well. A friend of mine, African-American, who went to Yale, studied literature, handed me a book and said, Jeanette, don't read anything else till you read this book. It's called A View from Cuiaba by a man named Peter Abraham's son. Mm-hmm. And after I read it, it was the first time I encountered that notion, and my feelings were a little bit hurt. It's like, wait, I'm a black person. And it kind of explained this whole idea of the need to go to draw in the community and then go back out before. Mm-hmm. And it finally made some sense to me. Well, then, reading about Peter Abraham's son, turns out he wrote this fabulous book called Minor Boy, but got very little attention for it, but Pride of Beloved Country. It was kind of, it got all this attention by the, and it's a wonderful book. I love Pride of Beloved Country. But by a white man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I said Peter Abraham's son is a black man who's not no longer living, but worth checking out. Out of print.
Find it in a good collection. I want to say thank you. I love Kitchen and Holden. This is a great send-off.